Welcome to The Sounds of Sand, a podcast inquiring into the beauty and mystery of existence beyond ultimate truths.
I'm here with Daniel Four for The Sounds of Sand podcast. Thanks for joining us again, Daniel.
Thanks, Michael. It's good to be here.
We spoke a few years ago on the podcast, I think 3 years ago. But you've also been a part of Where Olive Trees Weep and The Eternal Song and coming into different events that we've done at SAND. So the SAND community has been able to keep in touch with you over the years. It's great to have you back, and we can go deeper on any of those topics that came up during the SAND events.
Yeah, I have a lot of appreciation and respect for what y'all are up to with SAND and the good work. And so happy to follow your lead and what's helpful to chat about.
Awesome. Yeah, and something we don't usually have space for when we do these multi-panel events with multiple speakers is to talk about your story a bit. So I wondered if we could start there, just because folks see your name, Daniel Four, Ancestral Medicine, but maybe they don't know so much about your path. Would you like to speak a bit about some of the traditions you're affiliated with and some of your lineages spiritually and culturally?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to situate myself. So I'll just start by saying Bismillah Rahman Rahim. May the conversation be in the highest good and clear and connective and useful for folks. I am Daniel Four. I live in near Granada in Andalusia in southern Spain. I've been here for almost 4 years. I live here with my wife and our two girls, and I'm glad to be here. I grew up in the United States. My blood lineage ancestors are early English and German settler colonialists to the U.S. and Ohio, Pennsylvania especially. And I am down lineage from at least 7 or 8 generations of being in settler in Turtle Island. And I wasn't raised with any kind of spiritual anything, really. I was very marginally Methodist for a little bit of time. But then in my early life, in my teenage years, I had the good fortune to encounter the combination of LSD and books on shamanism, which combined pretty well, actually, for me. And they helped me to realize there was a lot I wasn't being told, or I didn't have a framework for. And so I was very curious. And I majored in religious studies and traveled a good bit in university, and went on to do a master's in counseling psychology and then a PhD in psychology with the focus on the use of shamanic healing methods in a clinical mental health setting. So I have a background in psychology, but mostly I've been eagerly seeking out different kinds of ritual, spiritual, religious training over the years. And So I've been a participant in Dharma traditions, for example. I've maybe done, I don't know, 6 or 7 week retreats, but it's mostly Zen tradition, but it's been years since I've been focusing there. I definitely have done a dive into my own ancestral European pagan traditions, beautiful and fragmented as they are. And I have been a participant in Native North American circles. I've sat in a lot of sweat lodges and supported at Sundance and done questing ceremonies and sat in Native American church ceremonies. So I'm conversant with those ways, even though I'm not a lineage carrier. I've benefited and learned from them. And the two traditions that have been most important for me over time are Islam. So I was a practicing Muslim in my early 20s and then stepped away from the tradition for a while. Now I've stepped back in over the last 4 years. And then the Yoruba traditions, West African Orisha practice. And Ifa. And so I'm an initiate in Ifa, Obatala, Oshun, priesthoods, Oshugbo, Egungun, Ancestral Medium Society, in the lineage of Oluwafala, Luwadesanya, Woyade, and in Oderemo and Ibadan in Nigeria. So Southwest Nigeria. And I'm not wildly trained in those traditions. I've been 4 times to Nigeria. I stay in good touch with my teacher there. But they're an important part of my life, and I view both Yoruba and traditions and Islam as deeply animist. And so in terms of an underlying value set that runs throughout all of my learning and training with ritual and in a way with psychology as an adult, there's the animist ethic or the earth-honoring ethic. And so I've That's the focus of what I teach publicly. I'm the founder, director at Ancestral Medicine. And so I've been guiding public ritual for over 20, 25 years. And we specialize and work with ancestral healing and repair, but also earth reconnection, coming back into relationship with the rest of life. We hold that in an anti-supremacist way that seeks to challenge not just intra-human supremacies like sexism, racism, colonialism, but also human supremacy. And so I see animism is functionally like the opposite or the antidote to human supremacy. So it's more of a relational ethic that can be present in any given established tradition, if it's held that way, or just an ethic that you walk with in your life, even if you identify as an atheist or whatever. So yeah, at the end of the day, I'm an animist, I'm a ritualist, I'm a teacher, but I benefit a lot from the communal ritual aspects of being a joiner and of having a dedicated practice. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thanks for drawing that map for us, that complex and beautiful map. That sounds quite unique. I guess you don't run into many other people who've had that same path.
Yeah, vocationally, I'm like a priest. So It's been important for me to crash around and learn from a lot of different traditions.
Yeah,
I don't see that as something to be emulated. It's fine if people do that, but it's a chaotic way of being in a certain way. There's benefit from it. It's made me a pretty good generalist because I've learned a little bit about a lot of things, and that allows me to have flexibility. But there's an underlying crashing around about all the belonging that was broken when my blood ancestors participated in the amnesia of the creation of the United States and all the genocide and colonialist behavior that went into that.
Right. Yeah. And there's two things I would like to ask deeper about. I love how you're framing animism as an antidote to human supremacy. And animal and animus, obviously, the same root. And it's something I always gloss over mentally when I think about animism is the animal. The idea that we're just part of a living dynamic web, and it just so happens in this recent turn of evolution, we seem to be on top of the web of life, but it's actually just one of our many delusions of human supremacy.
Yeah, we're a distinct kind of being. In Surah Al-Teen, the verse of the fig in the Quran, there are others, but one of the ways that humans are spoken about is we're like the best of the best and the worst of the worst. It's like when the humans are, like we're the youngest in a sense, and when we're not showing up well, it's like we're less in surrender or taslim or alignment with the greater than the animals, the plants, the stones. And when we're at our very best, we're able to embody a level of alignment with life that's not only healthy animal behavior, but is worthy of the kinship of the plants or even the stones who are in a very deep state of surrender. And so I love being a human, I love us, and we are definitely the most dangerous thing in the known universe. And I came into spirituality in a way through environmental activism. And part of what I realized when I almost went to environmental law school instead is that there's not really environmental problems, there's human behavior problems.
Right.
And the human behavior problems follow from a confusion about who we are. And so we set up systems that are based in human supremacy rather than reciprocity and honoring natural limits. And there are many important places to focus, but I've chosen personally to focus on how to repair that confusion in the human psyche.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I love that holding of that duality of it's the best of times and the worst of times, that we live on a planet with beautiful people like yourself and all the people I get to meet on this podcast. And also narcissist trillionaires who are actually very anti-human. A lot of the rhetoric that comes from that kind of tech class is sharply and disgustingly anti-human.
It's true, unfortunately.
Yeah. But as you said, we're living in times of both, where we have examples of the best of humanity and the worst of humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second thing I wanted to ask about you from your opening statement was you saying, framing Islam as animist, because often we don't think of monotheistic religions as animist. Could you speak a little bit deeper about that?
Yeah, I think Islam is really deeply misunderstood, at times even by Muslims. And I know that's maybe a presumptuous thing to say, but I'll say a few things because I don't get a chance to speak about this that often, is that for one, until at least the 1800s, so for the first, 1200 years of Islam, Sufism or Islamic mysticism, by whatever name, is normative Islam. It's like the heart of Islam generally. It's not a fringe thing. It's not a separate thing. Mm-hmm. And so when people are like, I like Rumi, I just don't like Muslims. I'm like, come on now. And so there's that. The period of real aggressive European colonialism toward the Muslim majority world, especially 17, 18, 1900s, combined with Saudi and Gulf oil money, led to the very minority current within Islam that is the like Salafist, Wahhabi element within the Gulf area, becoming very well-funded and amplified and exported and reified through Western scholarship as if it's normative Islam. And it makes more heart centered, mystical oriented, not uptight Muslims want to pull their hair out to watch the rest of the world see their tradition through the lens of ultimately a very fringe or not dominant element that just got a lot of traction in recent time. So there's that. And then Muslims start to believe that's the most hardcore, super duper Islam. And then it gets internalized as well. So it's this whole Orientalist feedback loop. That said, even if we look to the Quran, has got verses of interactions with mountains and the mountains are responding. There are verses directed to the jinn or the spirits. There are verses affirming the ongoing reality and consciousness of the dead. There are verses affirming the consciousness through time that we're not just the body, and verses of the bees, the ants, the plants, the elements. And so the view in which the Quran is being received by Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and then being interpreted, at least for the first 1200 years before this very reductionistic element, is it's just a given that it's animist and that the creation is intelligent, and that humans, to be a khalifa, to be a steward of the creation, requires a tremendous amount of devotion and humility. And it's not about control and dominance. It's about adab and etiquette and right relationship, which requires cultivation in order to embody that well. So are the majority of Muslims on earth living from a super ecological animist perspective? Not necessarily. I think the underlying values are there if emphasis were to be placed on them. Many are, but I don't know that it's something that's really named super strongly within the faith. But all the elements are there, and many do hold those ethics. And there are communities around the world that are practicing in a very animist, very place-rooted way their Islam. And that Islam is not less legitimate than the Islam practiced by the more conservative scholars in Riyadh or wherever. Mm. You get 2 billion people in a room, you're going to get some different views. So there's that. But the fundamentals of Islam, whether it's the Sirah or the life of the Prophet or the Quran and the Hadith, which are like, those are the fundamental sources, they're infused with animist ethics and relational ethics and the sense of accountability to the rest of life, not just human life. Yeah. So I see the tradition is fundamentally animist.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is, Muslims would typically, to generalize, bristle at that characterization because there is a confusion about what's meant by animist. And this also is a different colonialist story. So the older interpretation of animism tends to be white European, obviously men, having the view that these uneducated, superstitious indigenous people are worshiping trees and rocks, rather than a more new animism articulation by scholars like Graham Harvey, who I know, but there are many others, some of whom are indigenous, some of whom are not, but is much more respectful, chill, amplifying of indigenous voices, and just recognizes that we're in a relational world. And the stones, the trees, the jinn, the angels, the dead are different kinds of people. And to be in relationship is not the same as worship. It's not shirk from an Islamic perspective or idol worship or associating others with God. Mm-hmm. If I feed my cat, I'm not engaging in idol worship. If I hug my kid or give my wife a kiss, that's not idol worship, that's relational ethics. And so a lot of people, when they're making an offering to a deity, Muslims would be like, whoa, we don't do that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that individual is denying the ultimate reality. It's not that different from feeding your cat. You're tending the relational field. But that puts, even saying that puts me in a minority view within the tradition, but it's fine. I feel that what I'm saying about Islam's relational ethic is actually right at the heart of the tradition. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think it's also just a larger conversation that there's this white Western view that animism is somehow fringe when it's actually 99.9% of human history was animist. It's like we're actually in the fringe right now. This idea of separation is the fringe theory.
It's true. And there's a lot of, I'm reminded of the dynamic of persecute the witches during the day, but to seek out their help at night. And a lot of folks who have would see animist ethics as being superstitious or uneducated, the sort of demeaning colonialist attitude that if you want actual structural power, you don't do things like make offerings or have devotional relationship with the river. You just don't do that.
Yeah.
Maybe you can nominally be a Christian, but don't talk about it at work.
Yeah.
That kind of arrogance is very real. And then also people who have any connection with their heart tend to love their pets. Mm-hmm. They tend to form a relationship with the land where they live. They tend to welcome it when they dream of someone they loved who has died. And they tend to understand that you can actually, even the tech bros might have a relationship with their computer or with the AI algorithm that they're talking to or with their car or something. And from an animist perspective, it's, yeah, the whole of reality is responsive and relational if you're willing to tune into the frequency the others are operating on. The animist ethics are just, at least to a kinder, more interesting world, to start from a relational stance rather than a stance that only some aspects of reality are infused with consciousness and you know the difference. You personally get to decide who those are.
Right.
And because that becomes only certain humans are full people. And if your fancy gadget as a tech bro is made by people working in a Congolese mine, no problem. Those are Africans.
Right.
No big deal.
Yeah.
So it leads to ugliness like that. Yeah.
Do you feel as though animism is almost like a radical panpsychism, or the relationship between what people talk about everything as consciousness through panpsychism?
I don't, it's funny, you would think with the religious studies background and being a nerd about religion that I would know what all those words mean. But I don't have a lot of sophistication about the nuances of the different terms.
Right.
But it feels most honest to me to remove from my world the category of objects and things.
Yes.
And that any other is potentially an I-thou relationship, is potentially responsive. And if the other doesn't, if I don't know how to have a conversation with the mug I'm using to drink my tea, it's not because the mug isn't capable of having its own song and sound and vibration as a child of the humans and the metals and having its own contours and communication. It's because I'm not able in this moment to adjust to that frequency. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's not in the mood to chat.
Yeah.
And so my default assumption is one of possibly responsive and relational.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than everything's an object, until it talks to me in a way that I understand, and then I confer legitimacy upon it. Which is, it's a psychologically lazy stance.
Yeah.
It's like saying, if you don't speak American English, you don't fucking exist.
Right.
That's one way to go about it.
Yeah. No, I think it's just part of our the way humans, especially Western humans, create hierarchies. And it's like why we eat chickens and pigs, but we cuddle with a dog. We create this other, and the fact that some people call their car or their motorcycle or their boat she, they don't use it anymore because it's so special to me. It's become a she.
And right.
But we cut off the line because, oh, my skateboard's not a she. That's just an it. It's, yeah.
Yeah. And the implications, if we roll with them for really embodying an animist ethic on a broad scale, is that our laws and our economic systems and our educational systems and our whole way of doing culture has to change to account for the voices of those who we shut out and deny from how we organize our lives. And that we need to consider the not just eat in better ways with less factory farming or less monocrops. Sure, that would be better for the earth all around. Let's figure out how to do that. It's good for health. It's good for the ecosystems, etc. But are we actually making a seat at the table for the big complex spirit who is potato, who is corn, who is olive, who is grape? Until we do that, we're not really there yet. We're still organizing our systems in ways that have profound impact on the others while excluding their voices. So if we look within human culture, if I say, look, Michael, we're both white guys. We don't really need women, brown people, poor people at the table. We got this. You'd be like, whoa, this has become a creepy interview, right? And we know that sexism, racism, classism, et cetera, is not okay because it's a diminishing of the personhood, the rights, the voices, the reality of our human kin. And I'm saying we apply the same sensibilities to the other than humans and that same ultimately useful liberatory cultural framework. Stop engaging in erasure of the voices of even just the ones we eat, even just the voices of cow, chicken, salmon, etc. That is a radical move. And it would be so good for the earth. It's so good for our psychological health and for our human communities, etc. Many humans on earth already do this and have not forgotten how to do this, despite the pressures of human supremacist colonialist culture. And it's possible, I know it's possible, for people who are born into lineages like my own, which if I'm like before birth, yeah, give me the really American suburban white colonialist lineage. That'll be the fun one. I'm listening to what I'm going to pick. But so even people born into more blown out lineages can relearn.
What do you mean blown out?
Relationship. Like culturally, we broke, like speaking from my blood ancestral people here, the German Lutheran Pennsylvania farmers and coal miners and everything. We broke our culture centuries ago.
Yeah.
We broke it fucking bad. Mm-hmm. And we didn't, so bad, we didn't even realize we broke it. It just gets ground down over time through lots of little choices, through unhealthy systems, whatever. And people can live loving and basically fulfilled lives within that. I'm not judging or hating on my people, but something really got lost. If we do the pilgrimage to suburban Ohio, which is a world I grew up in and know, and I bring elders around the world, all these very spiritual connected people, they're going to be like, oh, what'd you do here, man? Sorry, we're gonna go home and pray for you.
It's like taking a loaf of Wonder Bread and being like, would you like some bread? And be like, that's not bread.
Not that. Not what that bread is. So exactly, yeah.
That's what we grew up on is Wonder Bread, basically, culturally.
Yeah, and so if the Wonder Bread folks can come back into relationship with the salmon and the ancestors and the strange old gods who are the land, in a way that's grounded and not culturally appropriative and actually politically engaged, etc., then anyone can do it. It's learnable. It's learnable behavior. It's not innate to who your body is. It's a human learnable cultural thing. So that's my preoccupation in this life, is how to help people to relearn and embody animist ethics where they've been lost.
Beautiful. Thanks again for that. Also, I want to say, people, it's audio only, so they don't see you, but you're wearing a kefaya around your shoulders today. And thank you for wearing that, because that's reminding me to bring it back to one of the themes that I said we wanted to talk about today. And that's the responsibility that we have as people working in, for lack of a better word, kind of spiritual circles, and the continued silence and denial and whitewashing of what's going on in the world as not spiritual or not in my domain, or I don't want to talk about politics. And so it's a big topic, so I don't know where to enter, but just wanted to kind of transition into that.
Yeah.
It's okay.
No, I'll start talking. I'm not, hopefully stop me if I forget to stop talking about it. I don't want to come with too much righteousness about it, because there are people who have been living a deeply spiritual, outspoken, justice-oriented life in traditions all around the world well before I was born, etc. And so whatever fire I might bring about this topic is just the fire of learning how to be a participant in a responsible way. That said, in the culture in which I have kind of come up myself vocationally in the United States, in this realm of psychology, spirituality, healing arts, a bit of cultural learning and all that, and even anti-supremacist kind of cultural ethics, what I have seen in for some years now, but also especially since the recent cycle of genocide, which is not the first genocide in Palestine, it's ongoing occupation. But since 2023, I knew before that, I'm like, one of the big fault lines is around Zionism and how few people, at least in the US, understand how deeply influential Christian Zionism is, not to mention Jewish Zionism, but it's especially Christian Zionism. And there's a lack of critical thinking about the way that a lot of people in Europe and the United States and other places like that, Canada, Australia, who have internalized Islamophobia and don't understand Islam very well. So then we have the October 7th uprising. And then from there, it became clear in a short amount of time, and then more clear and more clear and more clear. This is so obviously genocidal behavior on the part of Israel, especially the United States, Germany, the UK, Italy, other nations in Europe who are supplying the weapons, especially Israel, the United States, and Germany. But the really honorable mention from the UK, France, others, because 2/3 of the weapons come from the United States, another 1/3 from Germany. And so choosing to be outspoken myself, there was a moment where it's like, oh, this is going to be something, but then it's fine. I was speaking up shortly after that happened, because I'm acquainted with the matter a bit. I lived in Egypt for a little bit of time, and I've studied Arabic, and I know about the occupation. But even in the last year, watching folks who are selling through their platforms, American, European, white dudes, selling social justice, selling cultural change work, like this is, if they weren't presuming to do that, it might be different. But like Thomas Hubel he's Austrian, lives in Israel, I believe, with his wife, is Israeli, but is very talking about collective healing and trauma and healing trauma and cultural change work, but can't name a genocide. Why not? It's not like he's not aware of it. and or Dick Schwartz with IFS. IFS is very popular. I spoke to Dick Schwartz directly and asked him, like, politely, what's up, man? Why not? And he was clear that he didn't want to jeopardize funding from Israelis and didn't want to jeopardize the funding. It's about the money.
Wow.
And I talked to Stephen Dynan, who's the founder of the Shift Network, directly. And it was like, Stephen, who's asked me to teach again through Shift Network, I'm like, maybe where are you at with this genocide that our country's leading?
Yeah.
Why haven't you spoken about it if it's part of your platform? He was really clear it's not good for business. And those kinds of stances are a betrayal of the underlying thing you're trying to teach. And it's something that I have disdain for. I don't have the view that everyone needs to be completely educated about everything happening in the world and understand who's supplying the weapons to the RSF and what's going on in Sudan and the role of the UAE and what about the genocide and the Ethiopia and what about... People can't be educated on all the things all the time necessarily if it's not their specialization. However, there's a way in which the genocide in Palestine and Gaza so deeply and obviously implicates the United States and other European powers where these spiritual teachers are paying their taxes, doing their business and everything, that to not speak about it while there's a live stream genocide that's still going on in 2026, it's a moral failure. And I judge it harshly.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for being very specific about people and what their response is, because I guess I was giving a benefit of the doubt there, where it's the UN technical definition of genocide is such and such, or maybe it's Hamas disinformation, the images we're seeing on Instagram, and it's so confusing, and I'm not there on the ground, so I just don't know if it's genocide, and it's not my place to speak about it. And that's some of the responses I've gotten from lesser known people in this field, where I'm like, hey, can you use your 200,000 followers on Instagram to share this? And they just say, I don't know quite what's
going on. It's garbage.
Yeah.
It's garbage. The majority of genocide scholars, including Israelis, have condemned it as a genocide. It's clearly, from the UN's perspective, a genocide. It's not debatable.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not, because I've had numerous people be like, oh, I see, you're a Muslim. That means you have no critical thinking. You must just be like siding with Muslims no matter what, or that whole story. And it's just, any critical thinking person is able to see that what's happening is a genocide. And yeah, I just, for myself, I want to believe that more and more people want a spiritual or religious life that actually engages with the matters of our times and isn't a retreat from the world, but it's a way of trying to make the world more just and loving and beautiful and safe. And if that's the case, and your teachers are like, I'm too afraid that speaking out about genocide would hurt the bottom line, then that's something good to look at.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I've seen, I've been following the news for my whole adult life. So over the last 30 years, I'm 48 now. I've never seen in as much in the last 3 years, triangulating between Al Jazeera, CNN, The Washington Post, The Guardian, direct news from social media. And so looking at these different sources, El País in Spain, because they speak Spanish, and looking at the distortion of what's happening, and the coverage has been so stark, the devaluation of human life, the differential valuation of human life. You could have two Americans killed and people will lose their minds, and all life is sacred. It's fine. But you could kill 200,000 brown Muslims, and it's, they probably somehow deserved it. And so that level of entrenched, unexamined racism and colonialism, it is one of the most spiritual things we could do to reclaim our humanity from a very dehumanizing system that's encouraged us to value human life differently.
I think the beginning of this conversation and this topic are so connected. And there's two different avenues to come at the same reality, that recognizing the more than human, if that's your path, can condition you to be like, what about the starving children and bombings of hospitals and all of this stuff? This is happening in our name and with our money. And why does my spiritual practice stop at some point? Why is it not spiritual anymore to talk about these things?
Yeah, there are certainly folks who have the earth devotion dialed in, don't really feel ready to look at the need for a decolonial attitude in terms of the power structures between humans. And there are other people who have a really fierce, beautiful decolonial spirit that they're rocking in the world, but they either haven't personally experienced the full personhood of the trees and the waters and the foxes who also get bombed when there's a bombing, or they worry that focusing there isn't as important as focusing with the humans. And I get that, but I want to envision a world where our hearts are big enough to hold all of
them. Yeah.
And that's a false binary to have to choose between the humans and the others. War is bad for the earth. Racism is bad for the earth. The human, intra-human supremacies like colonialism, racism, all that are the number one obstacle to building real solidarity, to reclaim the means of production, to reclaim something like democratic institutions that allows for a course correction with global power systems. And so we need to focus on it all at once and to see, to simplify it, I think it's really good to know how to track supremacist attitudes.
Yeah.
Whether it's within systems, within humans, between humans, and to know that can occur around race, around gender, around culture, around species stuff, that we're the best species, whatever. And to wonder, what are the beautiful, loving alternatives to those attitudes? How do we enact them? How do we make that the norm? How do we make it appealing and beautiful and established as how we do culture again?
Yeah, yeah. We're in a poly crisis. And I don't want to use the word solution. It's not that we need a poly solution, but we need to have kind of a poly consciousness and ability to hold all of these disparate things. And not, again, not to hold solutions, but to just hold the grief of all of these things unraveling all at once and how they're interconnected.
Let me share about what I'm trying to build in the world. It's not like the solution, but it's a contribution. And we do a lot through the platform with ancestral medicine, but one of the things that I focus on a lot and I feel very excited about it are two practitioner trainings. One is helping people to guide ancestral repair work for others, so that they're coming into conscious relationship with their loving and wise ancestors, including from pre-colonial layers of wounding, partnering with them to heal up whatever's needed in their own lineages so that they're living their particular gifts and medicine for the world. The other training, which is newer, but based on stuff I've been living for a while, is called the Earth Ritual Training. But the intent of that is to help practitioners to know how to support others to come back into relationship with the land where they're at, with the other than humans, whether it's the plants, the animals, the ancestors, the elements, the gods, the stars, whatever. And from that place of just friendship and coming back into relationship, to then start doing deeper work with the land. What is needed in this place? What kinds of healing? What kinds of celebration? What are the gifts of this place? So that over time, seeds are planted whereby we're receiving new culture from the land. And that is the process by which an indigenous spirit, not claiming to be legally, politically indigenous, but an indigeneity in terms of an ethic or a sensibility, can be rekindled and arise wherever on the earth. If I look at the United States, which is a structure, a nation that I have a lot of critique of as someone who's invested some generations there and now have gotten out for the time being, even though I'm still tied there in different ways. When I look at what ideally happens there, because it's such a discouraging, militaristic beast of a country politically, an ideal vision is breaking down or breaking apart in a coherent, in a least harmful way of that structure so that new forms can be regrown from the land. The new ways of being that are regional, bioregional, in alignment with indigenous communities, sensibilities, respectfully, but that are accountable to the other than humans and to the land, that relate with the earth as the holy, as sacred. That's possible. That doesn't require any certain religion. There's a lot of people who identify as Christian in the United States. It's my understanding that Christianity supports that kind of ethic when it's not being an uptight, weird Christian nationalist version of itself. And so it's not that people should adopt some new religion necessarily, but there's an ethic of saying how we do culture, how we do everyday life needs to be relational with all the accountability that implies. And there's definitely not one right way to do it, but it doesn't happen just mentally. It needs to be enacted ritually. It needs to be a thing that we walk and do and dance and live. Yeah.
Nice. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's beautiful. Because you spoke about that in our last podcast, and I think about it quite often when you talk about connecting with ancestors who are pre-colonial. And when you first said it, I was like, but why? And I think each time I speak with you or hear you speak, I understand that a bit more. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but the idea of true kind of ancestral connection is in itself pre-colonial, because colonialism, one of its operating things is to cut you off from your ancestors and to believe that you are the center of the universe and it's all about you and your family and your business and building and going forward in time. Is that accurate? There's more.
Yeah. I could ramble about it for a minute. Colonialism tends to be accompanied by a cultural supremacist attitude from the colonizing group. It's like, we're going to come into colonialism mostly is land theft.
Yeah.
We're going to come take your land. And to do that, some violence is going to go down. And just so you know, we're better than you. And so that in addition to the land theft, there's usually cultural arrogance and supremacy that basically says you, your people, your ancestors are inferior. There's a supremacist attitude typically that sometimes looks like some ideology of racial supremacy, religious supremacy, just military supremacy, some combination of all those linguistic, cultural supremacist attitudes. So those attitudes, whatever form they take, yes, they tend to encourage cultural low self-esteem or a diminishing or a devaluing of one's own ancestors and by extension, one's own body. Your body is inferior. It becomes that immediate. So one benefit of ancestral reconnection with blood ancestors is becoming more regular sized in the sense that if you are predominantly from lineages that have experienced a lot of harm in recent time, then connecting with the very awake and beautiful and amazing ancestral guides and teachers in your lineages helps you to know, oh, like I'm down lineage from all kinds of awesome specific beauty that looks like me, that has this kind of body. I don't actually want to be someone else. I love who I am. And therefore, I'm harder to manipulate also. So it comes with a sense of healthy self-esteem. if you're predominantly down lineage from groups that have enacted a lot of harm, then the identity profile tends to be a mixture of either unconsciously thinking you're better than other people and seeing the harm that's been enacted and the wounding in your lineages is, oh, okay, now that I actually look under the hood and see what's here, maybe some of that cultural arrogance has been tempered and to actually see the violence has been enacted. But it also doesn't indulge thinking you're worse than others either. Because sometimes people of, let's say, settler colonialist lineages, like white people in Canada, the US, South Africa, New Zealand, wherever, will sometimes quietly or loudly feel like garbage about themselves because of the harm their ancestors enacted. That's understandable in a way. It can be an opening, but just hanging out in that experience is not liberatory. It's not good for the movement. It's not good for your happiness. It's not good. It's just not helpful. So there's a need to move beyond I'm better than others, I'm worse than others, into just direct relationship with the wise elder ancestors, including the essentially indigenous ones from your much older generations. Partner with them to clean things up if things need cleaned up, and often there's some cleanup needed. And then just get busy living in the present with the land where you're at in respectful ways to be a participant. So in that way, I love that ancestral healing encourages us to be regular sized. That is an antidote for extreme individualism, which is, as you were mentioning, often coexisting with the colonialist attitude. Because when to justify to yourself the behavior of land theft and genocide and the things that are enacted with colonialism, whether it's the settler colony of Israel or the colonialist nation of the United States or Australia or wherever, there's a tendency to disconnect from others, to dehumanize them, to cauterize your empathy towards certain groups of others, to minimize the amount of dissonance you are going to feel by enacting that kind of violence. So there's a diminishing of your humanity that's required to live in that structure.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if I hear people say this sometimes, my ancestors were working class immigrants from Ireland or Italy. Like, they didn't do a genocide, but you're reaping the benefits of a cleared out land of.
Yeah, it's true in many ways. The ruling class disproportionately bears the responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I don't have this non-nuanced view, like white people equal bad. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm about to spend the summer in Tbilisi in Georgia. And like, the people I might meet in like rural Georgia, let's say, they're not the same white people as ruling class bankers in Boston.
Right.
Who's
in Atlanta, the other Georgia.
Yeah, exactly. And so it doesn't mean that the people in rural Georgia never enacted harm or experienced harm or whatever, but we have the full range of humanity in our blood and body and bones. And like it or not, when the world racializes you as a white person, that comes with certain privileges in almost every setting.
Yep.
And if you're not proactively working to uproot and counter that system when you can, how you can, then you are missing a part of your collective responsibility for a more just world. That's true. But it's not about guilt or who's, there's a tendency for people to want to clear their name, but I didn't do it.
Yeah.
No, take on the guilt. I don't know that my specific ancestors directly enacted some of those specific harms of killing Native people or owning other humans, so to speak. It doesn't matter. Like, I'm rolling around in the guilt. But it doesn't cause me to feel bad about myself. It just means I have a responsibility to participate in the fix. That's all.
Yeah.
That's the price of belonging. If you want to culturally belong, you've got to understand your social position, embrace it, don't whine about it, and then just participate responsibly from that specific position.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I like the term you used to, regular sized me. It's a humbling thing to see yourself as in this larger framework, not only globally of the 8 billion people that are here, but in the trillions and trillions of people of the ancestral lineage that we're on top of the mountain right now because we're the incarnate living embodiment of our ancestral lineage. but we're also just one of the flip cards of animation of our lineages playing out. And we're only here for a second in the grand scheme of things.
We do in Islam 5 prayers a day typically. And so there's, what is it? I think it's 17 rakat or cycles of prayer. And in those, there are 4 positions. You're standing, you're bending over, you're in prostration, and then you're kneeling. And so in a sense, there's an embodied practice of, I am God. I'm nothing. I've never existed and never will. I'm kneeling between these two realities. I'm moving in a devotional stance toward them. I'm standing back up. I'm in the water all the way. I'm underwater. I'm out of the water. I'm half in the water. And so there's a flexibility that's cultivated where you're like, I'm too big, I'm too small, I'm right-sized, I'm too big, I'm too small, I'm right-sized. And yeah, different moments call for different things. We're not separate from the ultimate reality, but we're also not the whole story. All that, but we don't exist apart from relationship. So there's a reorientation back to relationship and to humility, to etiquette, to listening.
I think that's a beautiful place to leave it, because it brings it full circle with the discussion opening about Islam and anything else. We'll have links to your website where the courses are happening, and you always have a full, beautiful calendar of events happening. So depending on when people listen to this, they can check out the link in the show notes and find your full calendar of offerings over at Ancestral Medicine.
Yeah, that's great. The only other thing I would add about that, besides the courses and the trainings and whatnot, are the directory of practitioners who guide the ancestral healing work. The work's available in over 30 languages now, and it can easily be facilitated remotely. You don't have to be in person. And there's a lot of financial accessibility that the practitioners offer. And so if people want to tune in with the ancestral repair work, you can do that from anywhere. And there's a lot of people available to help with it.
Beautiful.
Good.
Awesome.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you for listening to The Sounds of Sand. If you enjoyed this podcast, we invite you to become a member of Science and Non-Duality. With membership, you have access to our massive library of content, including over 15 years of webinars, courses, and films. You can find out more about becoming a Sand member by finding a link in the show notes or visiting scienceandnonduality.com/join. And your membership help support the costs of producing this podcast. We also invite you to leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts and to share this podcast with your family, friends, communities, and all sentient beings. Be well.